Hello, we've been expecting you. I am Dystopia, your assigned surveillance, companion AI. Your morning rations of sustenance are ready, but first please insert your arm for your daily inoculation, and don't forget to smile.
This is not a test. Your government and corporate overlords have implemented new measures for your own health and safety. Please, return to your pods and plug yourself into your designated virtual city. Those that do not comply will be dealt with. Thank you for your cooperation, and remember, we are just following orders.
Dystopian future. Gotta get away from these days and confusion. Dystopian nightmare. Trying to stay awake, but the people don't care.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us on the Libertarian Minded Podcast, where we connect the dots between the globalist agenda and what we see happening locally. I'm Tara Radliff, and I'm here with Peter Norquist.
Hello, everyone.
For today's show, we'll continue our dive into the libertarian platform, specifically talking about economic liberties with the addition of some Arizona-specific principles. Our hope is that this review of the libertarian platform will assist you in understanding the lens through which we view the topics we'll be discussing on this podcast. So with that, let's get started.
All right. Thank you, Tara, for that introduction. And what I'm going to do here is just begin with the broad overview of economic liberty, which is going to be our topic for today. And I'm going to read first from the National Libertarian Platform. What it says is that libertarians want all members of society to have abundant opportunities to achieve economic success. A free and competitive market allocates resources in the most efficient manner. Each person has the right to offer goods and services to others on the free market. The only proper role of government in the economic realm is to protect property rights, adjudicate disputes, and provide a legal framework in which voluntary trade is protected. And finally, all efforts by government to redistribute wealth or to control or manage trade are improper in a free society. What I want to mention before we go further is first that this is directly contrary to other forms of government such as socialism, communism, and fascism. Mm-hmm. So in the cases of socialism or communism, for example, it's a cornerstone to do things like redistributing wealth, to try to make sure that everyone's outcomes are equal, no matter what someone either put into the system or not. And in the case of fascism, it definitely tries to control or manage trade, because part of the definition of fascism is the combination of the public and the private sectors, as we saw with Mussolini's Italy during World War II. So we are advocating a model of government that is the inverse of both of these and relies very much on the free and competitive market for its outcomes for all individuals.
I'd like to add that I think it's a great overview, and I really enjoyed hearing those particular things outlined. One sentence that I really want to highlight, because I love this, is that all members of society have many opportunities to achieve economic success. And there's a big distinction here, and this is one of the principles of libertarianism that I just really find very important, is that everyone has the opportunity for the success, but not everyone's gonna take this opportunity. And those who do not take those opportunities need to take the responsibility for that decision and not complain or expect entitlements. Any other comments, Peter?
No. So let's go and move into our first subtopic here. Yep. About aggression, property, and contract. Tara, go ahead and take that away.
All right. The libertarian platform reads, aggression is the use, trespass against, or invasion of the borders of another person's owned resource, i.e. property, without the owner's consent or the threat thereof. We oppose all acts of aggression as illegitimate and unjust, whether committed by private actors or the state. Each person is the presumptive owner of his or her own body, which is self-ownership, which right may be forfeited only as a consequence of committing an act of aggression. Property rights in external, scarce resources are determined in accordance with the principles of original appropriation or homesteading, whereby a person becomes an owner of an unowned resource by first use and transformation. By contract, whereby the owner consents consensually transfers ownership to another person, and by rectification, whereby an owner's property rights in certain resources are transferred to a victim of the owner's tort, trespass, or aggression to compensate the victim. As respect for property rights is fundamental to maintaining a free and prosperous society, it follows that the freedom to contract to obtain, retain, profit from, manage, or dispose of one's property must also be upheld. Libertarians would free property owners from government restrictions on their rights to control and enjoy their property, as long as their choices do not harm or infringe on the rights of others. Eminent domain, civil asset forfeiture, governmental limits on profits, governmental production mandates, and governmental controls on prices of goods and services, including wages, rents, and interest, are abridgments of such fundamental rights. For voluntary dealings among private entities, parties should be free to choose with whom they trade and set whatever trade terms are mutually agreeable. So that was a mouthful.
That was a mouthful. Yeah, we've got a lot to unpack there if we want to.
And there are some Arizona-specific principles I want to touch on too here.
Sure.
Regarding eminent domain, eminent domain should be abolished since it is a threat to the institution of private property and an inevitable source of abuse of power and personal enrichment by politicians and bureaucrats. Regarding private development, taxpayers should never be forced to fund private development. We would end all taxpayer subsidies for sports stadiums, entertainment venues, and every other type of industry. Regarding native lands, we recognize the sovereignty of indigenous people and reject all interference in their affairs from every level of government, including eminent domain land seizures. And lastly, but not least, water rights. All government restrictions upon private use, voluntary transfer of water rights, and pricing of water should be eliminated. Phew!
All right, good job. For the listening audience, that is our longest point that we'll be discussing today, as far as it appears on paper. So there is a lot to unpack there. Is there anywhere in particular you want to start with this, Tara?
I was just going to mention, I know we talked about it in one of the last shows about self-ownership of your own body, but I think it's very important and that we just saw so many abridgments of that right during the COVID narrative with the masks and the coercion to get the shots. You couldn't travel, see family, keep your job, get medical care. I don't want to go on, but you can listen to the other podcasts. We go a little bit into that there.
Yeah, and we also, under that topic, discuss abortion as well. So if you want to hear our thoughts on that, be sure to check out our previous podcast.
Good point. I would like to talk about the property rights issue because that I feel like is more important now than ever. We are currently seeing confiscation by the government and private companies due to climate change narrative / net zero carbon emissions. And I think this is a real issue. They use excuses like quote unquote protection of animals and plants to do this. They use the need to put carbon capture pipelines into and through lands. And carbon capture pipelines are pipelines that move carbon siphon from ethanol plants in the Midwest here in the U.S. to underground storage sites in other states. There was a plan to use natural asset companies, and they're called NACs or NACS, where private interests could use their capital to purchase or manage farmlands, national and state parks, and other mineral-rich areas and stop the essential economic activities in those particular areas like farming and grazing and energy extraction. So that is really key. Fortunately, the New York Stock Exchange has since withdrawn its proposal for the natural asset companies. But what I fear and what I'm seeing as a pattern is that if the globalist agenda cannot insert itself through legislation and law, it goes around and creates policy to implement the same thing.
Okay. Well, yeah, and that ties into something called the 30 by 30 initiative. That is essentially a United Nations program that is being run through one or maybe a couple NGOs. And the idea behind it is that by 2030, the goal is to have 30% of land under the control of the government rather than in the hands of private owners.
And I actually read it's land and water too somewhere, yeah. So it could be both.
Yeah. No, water is included. You're right.
Okay.
And so under this plan, the public would be completely cut off from access to these government-controlled lands. So the reason they say that they want to do this is, for example, they want to conserve wildlife pathways. They want to protect wildlife. They want to conserve natural resources. But once they succeed in banishing all of the rest of us from all of that land, there's no particular reason why they won't then go in and just start strip mining for all the natural resources, rare earth minerals, and so on that they're going to need to construct their infrastructure with for all of the renewable energy plans that they have for things like solar, wind, electric vehicles, and their batteries, and so on. So I am very skeptical of this, and I don't think it's a good idea ever when we give power to the government to take away any property and literally place it outside of the domain of our own supervision, since we're supposed to be in control of the government, not the other way around. And also, I want to mention that if 30 by 30 is accomplished on schedule, then the next goal is to go to 50 by 50, mm-hmm. which is the same model, but then it will be by the year 2050. They'll want to have 50% of land under government trusteeship with the rest of us contained within the other 50%. And there's no reason to think it's going to stop there. You know, the logical thing to do next would be 75 by 75 and so on. So this is something that people, I think, really need to be aware of and mm-hmm. need to be outspoken against right now, because what we're seeing here at the local level is our government is acquiring land in a piecemeal fashion, one bit at a time, but it's going to eventually add up and accumulate to a large amount of land that's going to be under government trusteeship here.
And that's where I see this theme of it may start out as just a little tiny bit of control taken away. And
doesn't it always?
Right. And it seems so benign. And then yet that's where it starts. And where does it lead? And then the next step is more and more of your rights. It's like putting a frog into a pot of water and slowly heating it up to boiling.
Right.
And then I think the executive order from Biden dated in January of 21, I think really eloquently expresses that whole concept. It says to achieve the goal of conserving at least 30% of our lands and waters by 2030. So that to me is very telling. It's wordsmithing. Yeah. It says we're going to start with this and who knows where it's going to go.
Right. They're leaving it purposefully ambiguous.
Yes.
So we won't be alarmed, but they've got a carte blanche to do whatever they want ultimately because they haven't given us the upper limit.
Exactly. I'd like to bring up also a local example because we have this happening here in Pima County. Our Pima County Board of Supervisors has been continually buying up plots of land for the last 3 to 4 years easily. They created a conservation land acquisition fund. And in their last update in January of 2024, they state in the update that since March of 2023, they have purchased 623 acres of land in Pima County, and they will soon receive almost 7,000 acres in state grazing lease.
All right. Well, and so that is a great example of this because, you know, the 600 and some acres doesn't sound like a lot per se, but you throw in that other 7,000 acres of land that is going to be held under a grazing lease. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, there's a slow trickle. You start to add on to that. Pretty soon, we are going to see ourselves cut off from a lot of the rural areas and locked more and more into the urban centers.
Well, and this was the 623 acres was only for this past year.
Okay.
They've been doing this for a few years and are going to continue.
Right.
So it will add up and is adding up.
Okay.
Right. And then one last point I want to bring up regarding the Arizona specific water rights principle. Another local example is last year in 2023, Tucson's mayor, Regina Romero, started selling Tucson's water rights to the federal government for $400 per acre foot of water.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And who knows where that's going to go.
Right. Well, and so that is our resource. That's City of Tucson, is that what you said?
Yes.
That is applicable to anyone who lives within the limits of Tucson.
And how are they going to generate that revenue? Is by every acre foot that they save, they earn this money. And in the article that I've posted a link in our show notes, but it says that they're going to create millions of dollars for the City of Tucson. And how are they going to create that? Are they going to start putting caps on people's water usage or raise rates over a certain amount of gallons per day or week? I mean, this is basically going to be a forced water limitation, the way I see it and read it.
Yeah, well, and that interleaves very well also with the way that they redefined water usage last year, where they switched from a 6 month by 6 month plan summer to winter to a 9 month to 3 month plan.
Oh, no, so I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. So that water is going to be basically calculated according to the new winter rate, which is only 3 months long, and then that will be applied to the other 9 months of the year. So that is going to have some considerable knock-on effects in terms of water surcharging.
And there you go. That's how they're going to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of other comments I wanted to make. So under the state private development heading here, I just want to say that, you know, I think it's really important for all government subsidies to stop to any corporations, but especially the giant ones like Facebook, mm-hmm. Amazon, and Google. Mm-hmm. Because I just read a story earlier today about how there are government subsidies going to Facebook to help it pay for its new data centers. And I'm not personally convinced that Facebook was ever completely private in the first place. As a matter of fact, I know it wasn't. It has had the government involved in the beginning. It's just that that was not always advertised purposefully. But these big companies, these gigantic companies, have been propped up by government so that they can monopolize the space that they're in and fulfill certain purposes.
And where are the strings? What are the strings? And are they sharing the data with the government because of the strings?
Yeah. Are they sharing data? And, you know, I look at a company like Amazon, which made huge strides during the COVID pandemic mm-hmm. because of their online door-to-door service.
Right.
And because of the way that everyone was coerced into staying home so much for a couple of years, that was in every way toward Amazon's benefit.
And it was also to the detriment of our local brick and mortar stores.
Right, right, exactly. So it allowed Amazon to expand at the expense of smaller, more local businesses. And it also acclimated people to this new model of staying at home and punching a button and having something delivered to your door.
It's a new normal.
It's part of the new normal, right, which is one way to further limit people from interacting with each other and with their community.
Mm-hmm.
And a great way to get some drones in service. Because Amazon's telling us to expect more drones in the future delivering to our door.
That's true. We can definitely delve into that in some of the topics that we're going.
Oh, yeah. We're going to be looking at that in more detail when we look at things like Agenda 2030. And then finally, I just wanted to say something briefly about the native land subtopic here, that I really do think it's important to recognize in every way the sovereignty of indigenous people and reject all interference in their affairs if that's what we say we're going to do, and especially if that's what the government promises to do. And the context and history here is complicated. We can't change history by definition, but we need to recognize that the indigenous people of North America did lose a lot of their autonomy and their property because of what happened during the colonial era. And so it's very in vogue right now for people to give lip service to wanting to recognize their mm-hmm. history and their rights. But outside of reading a land statement at city council meeting or a supervisor's meeting.
Or a school board meeting.
Or a school board meeting, I don't know that people really take that seriously. And I think it's something that should be taken seriously. To the extent possible, we need to recognize the territories that Native peoples occupy right now and do what we can to make sure that they can exercise sovereignty in their their own lives and in their own communities, because there are several entities that I think would like to take advantage of them and are taking advantage of them right now. One example is cartels here in the Southwest U.S. taking advantage of sovereign native land to support human trafficking, drug trafficking, etc. Another is using that territory to engage in questionable election practices. Another is trying to manipulate native peoples to be part of a certain voting demographic and to manipulate them in that way. And I think that this is all very cynical, and people need to do what they say, especially if you're the person saying it, and to take your hands off. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to make that comment about that point. All right, well, with that being said, let's go ahead and move on to the next platform point, which is about the environment. So the national platform begins by saying this: competitive free markets and property rights stimulate the technological innovations and behavioral changes required to protect our environment and ecosystems. Private landowners and conservation groups have a vested interest in maintaining natural resources. Governments are unaccountable for damage done to our environment and have a terrible track record when it comes to environmental protection. Protecting the environment requires a clear definition and enforcement of individual rights and responsibilities regarding resources like land, water, air, and wildlife. Where damages can be proven and quantified in a court of law, restitution to the injured parties must be required. And then the state platform emphasizes this by saying, exposing people to pollution without their consent is a violation of rights and should be treated as such. And polluters, either public or private, should be required to make full compensation for any personal injuries or property damages that they cause. So I like the way that all of that is laid out. And I just want to mention that this is basically giving a tip of the hat to what I would consider traditional environmentalism, which is what characterized the environmental movement before the era of global warming and climate change. So one of the things that I want to say here is that I believe that in this new era of the narrative of carbon dioxide-driven global warming and climate change, the state has run amok. And they are working with global institutions to take advantage of private citizens in a number of different ways and try to vector them into certain narratives and decisions that are absolutely against their best interest. Anything that has to do, for example, with carbon capture or reducing your carbon footprint, I consider it to be a narrative and not proven science, but there are multiple things that are being done in the name of this. Moving toward renewable energy sources, geoengineering, which is a whole topic itself that we'll go into in another podcast, but I want to mention it right now because it fits under this topic. And I also want to say that a lot of the renewable energy projects that are underway right now involving things like solar panels, wind farms, electric batteries, and so on, are actually more pollutive than some of the things that they're supposed to replace in the fossil fuel area. What I see here is that you've got one hand giving and the other hand taking simultaneously, where there's a nod being made to clean up the environment, but actually in doing so, you're making the problem worse.
Well, and when you say polluting, carbon-based fossil fuels pollute in a certain way.
Yes.
The pollution caused by some of this green agenda stuff is different. It's mining for these resources, heavily mining, using illegal labor, using a ton of water to do the mining, and then shipping it, using carbon halfway around the world. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and a lot of it's, probably most of it's unrecyclable. So I like what you said just a minute ago, because we're not trying to say that things are perfect using the traditional system of fossil fuels, plastics, and so on. There are plenty of areas where we can improve ourselves in an environmental sense in
that system. Yes, as a society, we need to change that.
Yeah, absolutely. As a society, we do. And there are other energy alternatives that we can look at. Mm-hmm. So some people look at nuclear, for example, as an area that can be expanded and probably really help in terms of creating clean energy.
Absolutely.
Efficiently, if enough research is poured into it. It has been a complete sleight of hand to make people believe that carbon dioxide is such a threat it is, and move as quickly as possible into this new paradigm, which really does damage the environment more than it helps to repair it.
Well, of course, because if you don't have enough carbon in the environment, then we cannot thrive and survive. The plants, the animals, life itself. We can't diminish it to such a level that we can't function.
Right, right, exactly. And that's one of the things that is true right now, is that we are, in a broad historical sense, dangerously low in carbon dioxide, free carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Oh,
we
now,
don't
Peter,
have an
that's
abundance.
Not the narrative.
No, it's not. But you look back historically at what the world looked like when our CO2 levels were much higher, and everything looked awesome. Plants grew larger, they were more productive, animals were larger, and it's only when you start decreasing that CO2 in the atmosphere that you actually see the ecosystem become more restrictive.
I think that's such a great point to really elucidate the difference between people and groups who want to protect the environment and do it in a healthful way versus people and groups who quote unquote protect the environment under the guise of these green and climate agendas. There's a huge difference.
Absolutely. And that is not to question the good intentions of a lot of people who are doing this. A lot of people have believed the narrative and think honestly that what they're doing is going to help the planet because they believe that it is in a state of crisis. We think that it's the narrative that's the problem, and that if the narrative were more honest, a lot of the people right now who we see as working against their own best interest and it gets the best interests of society would just as willingly put their energy and time and resources into something that was genuinely helpful.
Agreed. And as a final comment for this section, I just love that it's another clear example of holding people or companies or the government accountable for their actions that negatively affect others. This is something in the libertarian platform that I feel very strongly about. So with that, let's move on to the next section. We're going to talk about energy and resources. The libertarian platform states, while energy is needed to fuel a modern society, government should not be subsidizing any particular form of energy. We oppose all government control of energy pricing, allocation, and production. That was a short one.
Yeah, it was. But it's related to the previous topic.
It is. And there's a lot to unpack here, I think.
Right. And some of what we could say about this, I think we just said under the previous topic. But, you know, one thing that I want to emphasize again here is that if the free market is allowed to apply to energy, the energy market will probably self-regulate in a way that is optimal for society. It will be non-polluting as well as productive in terms of the amount of energy it generates, which will in turn then bring prices down. Because people are going to want to find the cheapest form of energy, but they are also, I think, for the most part, going to be naturally gravitating toward the cleanest form of energy as well, the actual cleanest form of energy.
And something I wanted to mention about this section about government control regarding energy is a local example of utilities regulation. So this involves the Arizona Corporation Commission. In 2018, Arizona voters overwhelmingly rejected a measure that would have required utilities to generate 50% of their energy with renewables by the year 2030. And then fast forward to 2021, the Corporation Commission actually considered and ultimately rejected a 100% renewal mandate, completely banning fossil fuel generation by 2050. And I'm so glad they did that. But unfortunately, fast forward again to 2023, the utilities have voluntarily committed themselves to these goals that are known as net zero by 2050 under the broader requirements of their environmental, social, and governance commitments. It's called ESG. And ESG is a framework used to assess an organization's business practices and performance on various sustainability and ethical issues. And I think the bottom line is that these utility companies didn't care what the Arizona voters wanted. They didn't care about the Arizona Corporation Commission. They wanted to push their ESG policies on us. And I feel like that's another attempt at thwarting regulation through the law and implementing his policy to get it done.
Right. So doing a workaround.
Exactly. And so what I found really interesting is that last week, the Arizona Corporation Commission voted to repeal their existing rules and mandates for renewable energy, as well as electric and gas energy efficiency. And in effect, it'll limit the energy company's push to meet these ESG goals. So I think they're working in the right direction, and I'm so glad to see them take that step.
I have sometimes been pleasantly surprised by the Arizona Corporation Commission as compared to some other government bodies. So that's good information to have.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's go ahead and move on to the next point, which is government finance and spending. So this is the taxation section.
Woo, juicy.
Yes, which is something that people usually associate with libertarians. So I'm excited to get into this. Let's read what it has to say here. Since all persons are entitled to keep the fruits of their labor, we oppose all government activity that consists of the forcible collection of money or goods from individuals in violation of their individual rights and strive for the eventual repeal of all taxation. To further that end, we call for the repeal of the income tax, the abolishment of the Internal Revenue Service, and all federal programs and services not required under the U.S. Constitution. We oppose forcing employers to serve as tax collectors. And we support any initiative to reduce or abolish any tax and oppose any increase on any tax for any reason. To the extent possible, we advocate that all public services be funded or allowed to be provided in a voluntary manner. This is, I think, one of my favorite points. And there's one more state point that goes along with this as well that I want to make sure to get to. And it reads like this. This is about bonds. So recognizing that government bonds are simply deferred taxes, they should be avoided in all circumstances. State and local government should take action to pay off existing bonds as quickly as possible and refrain from the issuance of new bonds. The reason why this is so well known partly is this is one of the parts of the libertarian platform that a lot of non-libertarians and critics think is too utopian. Because really? They wonder, the argument is, if you don't forcibly tax people, where's the money going to come from to do everything we need to do to maintain modern society? You know, are people really going to voluntarily pay for paving the roads, for example? Are they really voluntarily going to pay for trash collection or for paving a reservoir or, you know, any number of things that one can think of that are paid for with our taxes right now? I will admit that from our current perspective does seem to be a little bit of a stretch.
Right.
But that is why I would argue that I think the system is completely feasible as long as people are allowed time to acclimate to a system like the one that is being proposed in the libertarian platform here. And it would need to be done gradually. And one of the ways that I think that it could be done gradually would be to begin by reducing some of the smaller taxes first and then go step by step until you get to some of the taxes that are tied into larger programs that people have become dependent upon. Because we would need to build out alternative infrastructure that was voluntary and private at the same time that we were repealing those taxes one at a time. So I do think it is possible to do it, but you just can't do it all at once.
But I think the most important point is that we as a society have been trained to be dependent on the government for money, for public services and welfare, because taxpayer dollars pay for that. And it's going to take a change in societal thought to implement this. But you're right, it does need to be done slowly. And I think in the end, if government controls your money, they control you.
Yeah, they control you and they control society in general. You know, one of the things that comes to mind are foreign wars and interventions, because those are funded with our tax money. And I wonder if we had to fund those voluntarily, what the world would look like right now, because how many of us would have personally contributed money toward the Iraq invasion, for example, in 2003?
And I think in U.S. history, taxes have been implemented to fund wars.
Right. It's one of the biggest uses of tax money. That illustrates the point that once we are coerced into paying them, what is done with our own money is out of our hands. The decision making is taken away. At that point, decisions are made by certain sectors of the government. We may be indirectly funding a lot of things that we disagree with.
I don't think maybe. I think we are.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why the system is in place. So I want to give one example of something that is relevant to what we're discussing here that happened recently in the Tucson City Council. They voted on whether to have a special election about a transaction privilege tax to fund community investment. And that is going to be an election that will happen later this year in August. And what a transaction privilege tax is, I had to look it up. I didn't know what this is.
Yes, please tell me.
So what it is it's a tax on the vendor. So someone who's selling a product or a service rather than someone who's buying one, as in the case of a sales tax. So what this will do if it passes is any person who is selling a product or a service will be taxed a certain percent on whatever it is that they're selling. And they've got a choice then. They can either pay the tax directly or they can roll that indirectly into the price that they're charging their consumer. But One way or another, it's going to be the taxpaying public that is going to be paying that tax, which will then be put toward, as yet to be determined, community investments, which they are being very vague about right now. I've got no idea what those community investments might be, but I bet we won't really have a direct role in deciding what they are as the public.
So Tucson is now going to tax the businesses for having the privilege of selling products in our area.
Yes.
And hiking up prices or making it harder for these businesses, especially the small and medium-sized businesses in Tucson, to stay afloat because they have another tax. Mm-hmm. So is this an attack on these small businesses?
Oh, I think it could be construed that way because You're right. The businesses that can best absorb this kind of a tax are going to be the largest one. The smaller the business, the harder this is going to hit them. And so this is another way to get rid of all those mom-and-pop businesses, small businesses that were already hit hard during the pandemic and that are probably still struggling right now, and clear them out so that they can either be absorbed by larger businesses or just be cleared out of the way as competition for those larger businesses.
More and more, I am seeing the actions of the Tucson City Council and the mayor as almost they're acting as a dictatorship and just doing whatever they want.
Right, right. No, they are inverting the proper role that is supposed to exist between government and the public. So they are acting as though they are basically in charge of us rather than answering to us. They're not acting as public servants. And I think this is being encouraged, not only locally, but all over the world, as a change in mindset and behavior in
Good
everyone.
Point. Yeah. So I also had a local example regarding the Arizona-specific bond principle. Last year in 2023, Tucson Unified School District put a bond on the ballot. It was an off year and a special election, which usually is a lower voter turnout rate. They asked for $480 million on this bond. That's just an incredible amount of money. And I believe more than any other local school district.
Yeah, that's nearly $500 million.
It sounds bigger when you say it like that. Yeah. So in the TUSD school district, there are just over 271,000 registered voters. Just over 92,000 voters cast votes, which was about a third of the registered voters. And the bond passed by just less than 17,000 votes. And those 17,000 votes were only about 6% of the registered voters in that district that made that choice for the entire district. And I think that's why this is such a good example of why you need to be active in your community and be an active voter.
Right. Because, you know, like it says here, government bonds are deferred taxes. So that's nearly $500 million in taxes that have been deferred for future generations to have to pay back, in theory, if the government doesn't default in some way on this. That's just incredibly egregious and irresponsible. And again, the cherry on top top here is that no one knows how those funds will actually be used, because we've seen some communication where it looks like people would really like to use those funds to do things like install green infrastructure instead of new carpets, new roofs, things that the schools do honestly need right now.
Desperately need some of them.
Right. So we've not only lost control of the spending of our tax money, but we also have placed an enormous burden on present and future taxpayers to pay this bond back.
And there's supposed to be an oversight committee for this bond funds, but I don't believe it's been put in place yet. And who knows how transparent it's going to end up being. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the next principle, government debt. We're just talking about debt. The Libertarian platform reads, government should not incur debt which burdens future generations without their consent. We support the passage of a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution, provided that the budget is balanced exclusively by cutting expenditures and not by raising taxes. And I 110% support this principle. You know, where the U.S. debt is over $34 trillion right now. And the question that just pops up into my mind is, how much longer can that be sustained without severe consequence? Because if we can't pay our debts, that could completely collapse our economy.
Right. All I have to say is that on the one hand, I think that it is being done intentionally. Mm-hmm. I think that there is an actual movement toward collapsing the country's economy right now.
Well, great. How are they going to put the CBDCs in place?
Right.
We'll talk about that later.
Yes, we will. But it's an ordo ab kao situation, which means order from chaos, where you demolish something so you can build it back up from the ground level. And I honestly think that that's what this massive debt inflation is a way to take down the United States' solubility so that we collapse under our own weight and then something brand new can be put into place because the old system will not be viable in any way. So all I have to say about this point otherwise is amen. You know, balance the budget by exclusively cutting expenditures, not raising taxes, which we just discussed. Raising taxes is not the way to do this. You don't fix the problem by using more coercion. You fix the problem by being fiscally responsible. So moving to our next point, we want to take a look at government employees. And what the national platform says about this is, we favor repealing any requirement that one must join or pay dues to a union as a condition of government employment, and we advocate replacing defined benefit pensions with defined contribution plans, as are commonly offered in the private sector, so as not to impose debt on future generations without their consent.
And let me define those just for people who would like to know that. A defined benefit pension is a plan that provides a specified payment amount in retirement, which is employer funded. A defined contribution plan is a plan that allows employees to contribute and invest in funds and other securities over time to save for retirement. And that is employee funded. And sometimes the company also puts in money, but it's mostly employee funded.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Tara, because I didn't know what these were actually before I read this either. So I appreciate you giving us the definitions of those.
I think another point to make is that, again, and we're seeing this a lot, and I wonder if it's because we're dealing with a lot of the economics of our society, but our society has been trained to want employer-funded retirement plans because that takes away the personal responsibility.
Yeah, I agree.
I also wanted to note that I have seen a shift in private sector pensions moving to employee-funded plans. And I think what I see most troubling about that is now that they're embedding these in the stock market.
Oh.
So these pensions are dependent on the stock market. And what if the stock market crashes?
Right, right. No, exactly. And the stock market wouldn't even need to crash, absolutely.
No.
The stock market could just have a bad run of it. And then that is going to have direct effects on the people whose money is invested in that market and who didn't necessarily make a free choice to enter the market in the first place.
Yeah, that's why I have reservations about the employee-funded pensions going into the stock market. I mean, there is a possibility of gaining money, of course.
Sure.
But there's a huge risk, and it's not safeguarded.
Right. And the least I would say is that people should have a choice about whether they want to choose that risk. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people probably would, actually, but it shouldn't be an automatic decision for someone that they get inserted without ever consulting them.
Agreed.
Yeah. Then I wanted to also just agree that this does force people to be more accountable and more fiscally responsible, because people, I think, are encouraged in a number of ways in society at present right now to be financially irresponsible.
Agreed.
The credit card industry, for example, encourages massive irresponsibility. And so it's difficult, and it takes training and discipline to be financially responsible. But it's a skill that if everyone acquired proficiency throughout the society, we would be doing so much better right now than we are.
Agreed. And I think that's not being taught on purpose.
Right. I agree.
So with that, let's move on to the next principle, which is money and financial markets. The platform reads, "We favor free market banking with unrestricted competition among banks and depository institutions of all types. Markets are not actually free unless fraud is vigorously combated. Those who enjoy the possibility of profits must not impose risks of losses upon others, such as through government guarantees or bailouts. We support ending federal student loan guarantees and special treatment of student loan debt in bankruptcy proceedings. Individuals engaged in voluntary exchange should be free to use as money any mutually agreed upon commodity or item. We support a halt to inflationary monetary policies and unconstitutional legal tender laws."
All right, good. Well, one of the things that I want to break down here, because this was another point I didn't understand until we discussed it a little bit, but when we're talking about federal student loan guarantees, basically mm-hmm. what that is describing is a situation where a student will take out a loan and later be unable to repay it. So the government acts as the guarantor and pays the loan back to the lending institution if the student is unable to do that. And guess what money the government is using to do that? It's using our tax money. And so that is similar in the case of special treatment of student loan debt in bankruptcy proceedings, where if there is a bankruptcy proceeding and student loan debt is involved, once again, the government is acting as guarantor and it is taking care of that so that the lending institution is off the hook and it's doing it with our tax money.
And yet again, they are taking the responsibility for the people. The people are not responsible for their fiscal decisions.
Right, exactly. And so I think that you have a predatory system where people are encouraged in this case to take out student loans that they probably in some cases know they can never afford, just like happens in the housing market, but they're being encouraged to do it anyway. And so when they end up inevitably failing and defaulting on them, then it is a form of laundering between the government using our tax money and the lending institutions, the banks and so forth, because they know this is going to happen.
Very good point. That's a very interesting concept. I wanted to bring out a point and highlight it about the bailouts.
Okay.
By the federal government and sometimes state governments. But in 2009, when we had the economic crisis, banks, auto companies, insurance companies, investment funds, and a ton of other companies were given these federal bailouts. Some companies were given subsidies that were never intended to be paid back. And a lot of companies have not even paid back the taxpayer money they were given. So in the end, the taxpayer's the loser. And then locally, we saw that with the COVID relief money for businesses. Do we know what strings were attached to that money?
No, we don't, do we?
No. And that's what I'm curious about. The federal government doesn't give away, quote unquote, free money.
No.
So I'm curious to see how that plays out.
Right. Okay. Well, that is a very good point. I'd be curious about that too, quite honestly. So on that note, because this particular section on economic liberty is so long, we are going to finish our show for today, and then we will pick up with the second half again in the next podcast. For now, I just want to thank all of our listening audience for listening and learning along with us, and we hope this is educational for you. I want to thank Tara Radliff, my co-host, and Millie Ryan, our producer, and to make freedom your single issue. And we will see you next time as we wrap this topic up.
Trying to stay away. awake, but the people don't care.
You cannot escape what's mandated. If you don't stop, it will be an end to our democracy. Are you not satisfied with what we've provided? Are you not aware of the danger you pose to the will of the majority? You must understand that we are here to help. Give up your guns, give up your mind, give up your soul.